Britain had learned a great deal while engaged against French and Native Americans during the Seven Years' War, but those lessons had grown somewhat stale by 1775, while British commanders, including veterans of North American fighting, such as William Howe and Thomas Gage, understood the importance of tactical flexibility and irregular combat, initial engagements showed that the standard tactics of the British Army would once again be required to endure a steep learning curve. So writes one commentator about British military tactics of the American Revolution. But what did that tactical flexibility look like? Probably not what we imagine. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is John Hall, the Ambrose Haseltine Professor of U.S. Military History at the UW-Madison, and welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you very much, Norman. It's a great pleasure to be here after a long while.
We easily simplify the way combat took place during the Revolutionary War, and there were more complexities than we can imagine right at first glance, just among the nature of the combatants, their points of reference. So before we get started, who are we talking about in terms of those who actually had tactics?
Any of the combatants in this war, but this war is properly considered the Second World War, the First World War being the Seven Years' War, or as it was known in North America, the French and Indian War being another scale, conflict rather, on a global scale with multiple nations and a variety of Native allies involved. And so you have a multiplicity of combatants here. Of course, this is, you know, most famously a contest between patriots and their British antagonists, but the British bring with them German allies, oftentimes fairly mischaracterized as mercenaries. You have Canadian militia troops, which remain loyal to the Crown. There are American militia troops that are loyal to both sides. There are provincial forces, which are early forms of semi-professional armies that some of the colonies had come to rely upon that will fight on both sides as provincial formations for the British, but they'll mostly be incorporated into line formations or somewhat regular formations of the Continental Army at that time. And of course, this really becomes a global war in 1778, and you have French and Spanish forces making common cause, if not in the case of Spain, as a direct ally of the nascent United States. And then least we'd be remiss to neglect also attention to Native combatants in this conflict, the bulk of which who were engaged were generally sympathetic with the Crown for reasons which we might get into. But there were some Native nations that did ally with the United States and provide measures of military support.
As long as we've mentioned the background in the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, what sort of tactics do we see there, and to what extent did they carry over into the American Revolution 20 years later?
Well, the French and Indian War, or the Seven Years' War, was the ultimate contest in a series of four wars between France and Britain in North America for imperial ambition, essentially, ultimately control of the continent. But that final fourth conflict was unique in a number of regards, one of them being that it was started by an American provincial, George Washington, not pinning the entire war on George Washington. But these other previous wars all began in Europe and ended up having off-theater analogs in North America. This was a contest that actually started over British and French ambitions in the Ohio country, and Lieutenant Colonel George Washington played a leading role in that one. It's also unique because it was decisive. There was a vanquished power. France gave up its North American continental land possessions in the aftermath of that war, but also because this is the only one of these wars in which both sides relied predominantly on regular forces, sending royal forces, the professional forces, the creme de la creme of each of their armies to North America to do the bulk of the fighting, which is not to say the militia and provincial forces were not involved. They were very much involved. But it was, I think it'd probably be a mistake to call it a dress rehearsal for the American Revolution because it was a war of such immense consequence in its own right. But it did introduce to these professional formations the unique challenges of campaigning and fighting in a North American environment that was very different from what many of them were used to on the European continent, in which, you know, even at this time in the 18th century, you're talking about very small, compact battlefields. You have here and there woods, but lots and lots of open terrain under cultivation, which makes for good battlefields with linear tactics, riverine logistics, all sorts of things that produced a system of tactics that was appropriate for that theater that was not quite appropriate for the North American theater. And already by the time of the Seven Years' War, the French had been very reliant upon Indian allies and had developed a particular acumen and kind of a long-range raiding kind of warfare, which some people today might describe as a guerrilla kind of warfare. But it is an irregular kind of warfare that did not use linear tactics. But you will see in the French and Indian War linear tactics imported to North America and refined over the course of this war. And so this is one of the great myths of the American Revolution is the British don't know what they're doing. They learn a lot of lessons in North American woodland fighting in that earlier war. And so too does George Washington, you know, who commands he's not primary command, but he's an acting command of the Virginia Regiment of Provincials throughout that conflict.
At the age of 23.
He's a very young man, a tyro indeed.
And you said, I can't resist asking, you said that Washington actually started that war?
Well, he was sent out on a diplomatic mission to tell the French to get out of what is to that present day Pittsburgh, right? Fort Duquesne is the fort that the French had built there at the confluence of the Monongahela, the headwaters of the Ohio. That was a fort that the French used to defend their claim that they had the right of preemption over the Ohio country. And the British, of course, contested that claim. It was absolutely intolerable to British imperial interests and to colonial economic interests in the region. And so he was sent out there with a demand to the French to move off and ended up getting into quite a fiasco when a Iroquois ally of his, upon whom he was reliant for some measure of diplomacy, actually assassinated a French nobleman who was sent out to treat with Washington. And things more or less devolved from there.
You've mentioned this term several times now, linear tactics. Is that what we imagine it to be, in that you have these sort of quadrants of men who it's almost like machine-like. The whole square moves around, and the front people then stoop down and reload while the line behind them fires these inaccurate muskets at just whatever moves.
Yeah, more or less. The fact that we refer to them as linear tactics, oftentimes I think they're also referred to as Napoleonic tactics. And I think, you know,
this
people have seen
the
recent blockbuster movie on that subject probably can form an accurate picture of this. Or anybody that's been to any Civil War reenactment has some sense of what we're talking about. You mentioned sort of the square formations, which is a permutation on the linear tactics, which the Duke of Wellington famously uses at the Battle of Waterloo, but is actually very uncommon in this era. Those square formations were more of an artifact of the earlier days of gunpowder when armies had matchlock muskets, which were more difficult to load, very cumbersome, much shorter range, and had to have a burning match or fuse on it at all times to ignite the powder in the pan. To provide the ignition that would send the cartridge or the ball hurtling down the barrel. because those early firearms were so vulnerable, they had to be married with pikes, you know, old-fashioned, long, pointy spears. And so the Spanish tercio is an example of one of these square formations, which is like a bristling square porcupine on the battlefield, which could fire in, you know, 360 degrees, more or less, ignoring the corners, perhaps, and then when need be for defensive purposes, have the pikemen within the square lower their pikes and provide pretty good defensive measures.
So what's happening then by the time we get to Lexington and Concord and the shooting part of the American Revolution?
Yeah, so by that time, matchlock muskets have replaced that older inferior ignition system. And we still think of this, right, of being very old-timey, right? You still have to have a flint, and when the hammer drops, the flint strikes a plate, which produces the spark, which ignites the powder. But it is a little more weatherproof. It's actually considerably more weatherproof. You don't need the match lit at all times. These weapons have gotten quite a bit lighter as well. And they have pretty good accuracy for a smoothbore musket. I mean, these are not the main infantry arms are not rifled. Rifles are certainly part of this war, which is something we absolutely have to talk about if we're going to talk about tactics in the American Revolution. But the formations, I think a lot of people look at these linear formations and think, my God, what idiots. Why are they doing
that? Out in the open.
and the reality is that the tactics made sense given the technology that they had at the time and the ends, ways, and means they were pursuing and that they had available to them. So from a European context, again, crowded space, you know, very populated, predictable avenues of approach, you can't stop an invading army with loose order skirmishers, you know, what seems to be the common sense way of fighting, you know, every man to his own tree. You can't stop an attacking force doing that.
It's too sporadic.
It's too spread out. And even in North American conditions, if you're trying to fight that way and there is a concerted enemy effort to push through it, they can push through it. So sometimes if it is absolutely essential to deny terrain or take terrain, you do need to mass your firepower, and they would mass the firepower by using these formations. We refer to them as linear tactics as shorthand, but there are variations on that as well. Sometimes they will use a column formation. So if you can imagine, you know, a marching band on parade, but take away their instruments and give them rifles. So you have a narrower frontage, but much greater depth in the formation. You would use something like that clearly if you're just marching over distances and out of contact with the enemy because you can move faster. But under certain circumstances, you might want to use a formation like that for its shock value to move through contested space very, very quickly and to punch through an enemy line. And in fact, this is one of the great debates amongst military theorists and tacticians of this day as to which is the more appropriate formation for modern combat as it's exercised in the 18th century. And, you know, that do you do it in line or you do it in column, or do you do what the French eventually figure out is the optimal solution and to use the order mixed, which is a combination of the two. And so there are any number of permutations that you could use. But the idea is to allow your forces, or rather array your forces, so that you can maximize your ability to mass the effects of your fire, your musketry, on enemy forces.
Both armies, though, both forces in full view, it's almost like a kind of a mass duel.
In some respects, it is if both sides are electing to join in combat. And with all of the most famous engagements, most of the famous engagements of the American Revolution and the War for Independence, that is the case. They are willing combatants, and they are going to do this. There are some notable battles that represent ambushes. The Battle of Oriskany, which on a per capita basis is the bloodiest battle of the American Revolution, is a massacre of New York militia forces and their Oneida allies. An ambush of those forces by Canadian Rangers and their Iroquois allies. And because it is an ambush, sort of a surprise attack, The fighting is desperate and
close quarters,
very close quartered, and the results are devastating.
The ambush, is that a concept that that the Europeans and the colonials picked up from the Native Americans?
No, I would not say that. An ambush, you know, as a tactic, is probably as old as the phenomenon of human combat itself. Usually, you could describe Native tactics as employing a formation that you could describe as a half moon, which is more of a meeting engagement, to use present day doctrinal lexicon, where they would move in open orders over terrain with skirmishers, if you will, although these formations are so loose, you might consider every member of the formation a skirmisher. They're using kind of contemporary light infantry tactics, frankly, and trying to identify an enemy body that they wish to take by surprise, but not necessarily to ambush then. So once they identify what it is that they're trying to attack, the half moon then captures the idea of a double envelopment. So skirmishers on either side will rapidly envelop either flank of them, and what they're trying to do is cut off the enemy body they're attacking. And that's true basically at any scale. I mean, if it's a small war party or even a hunting party of three people, right, that's their target, they will use those tactics. If it's an entire village, they will use that same half moon tactic, just on a much greater scale. Where the ambush would come in Native military traditions is they always know that their Native enemies are going to have some sort of what we would today call a quick reaction force ready to come to their aid. And so time is of the essence. They do what they can as quickly as they can. And in Native cultures, this oftentimes meant taking prisoners. They valued human prisoners very, very highly. So they would complete the attack, take as many prisoners as they possibly could, and then leave, knowing that they would be pursued. And they would oftentimes, as a defensive measure, then at some point try to set up an ambush to attack their pursuers. Alternatively, if their pursuers are kind of know their own backyard better than the invaders do in this instance, they might anticipate where that fleeing war party is going and ambush them on their way back home.
In the American Revolution, we haven't talked yet about cavalry.
Yeah, we don't often talk about cavalry in the American Revolution because it is a theater that is not well suited to cavalry, which, you know, strikes a lot of people, I think, is surprising, given when people think of, you know, American military history of bygone eras, they think of a man on horseback.
All those Virginians.
Yes. And it is quite true that in early American history, you know, bleeding over the 19th century, most volunteers, formed large proportions of active field armies for all of 19th century American military history, refused to volunteer as infantrymen. They wanted to go to war on horseback, a lot more adventurous and a lot less tedious, I think they thought. And also, if any harm was to come to their horse, they would bill the government at inflated rates what they thought their horse was worth for their sacrifice for the country. But at the time of the Revolution, you know, the war is pretty much confined to the eastern seaboard and the western frontier, what we think of as the old Northwest, is not terrain that is very conducive to traditional cavalry tactics. But on top of that, there's not a lot of good horse flesh in North America this time. Not the kind of horses that are needed for cavalry operations. And so we don't see a lot of cavalry. Ultimately, the British do send over one regiment of cavalry. The Americans will form cavalry units. Initially, the cavalry is put under the command of Kazimierz Pulaski.
Oh, the Polish.
A Polish adventurer, yes. Mm-hmm. He takes command of the cavalry. I suspect largely because Washington doesn't really know what to do with them. I mean, knowing how to ride a horse, you know, does not extend to knowing the art and science of cavalry. Cavalry will be more important in the Southern theater of operations, especially once that becomes the main locus of the war in North America, at least after 1780. And so there you will see Loyalist, provincial, British, and American cavalry units. Two of the most famous units in the conflict are Bannister Tarleton's American Legion and Light Horse Harry Lee Legion, Lee's Legion, which are composite forces of infantry and cavalry.
We're going to look at how well trained or not some of the American forces were compared to the British when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest John Hall, and we're looking at tactics during the American Revolutionary War, this war that had so many different kinds of constituents to it that it could well have taken some time for things to settle down as to how it was actually fought. And you've mentioned the militias, John, and I remember in a previous conversation we had some years ago about the War of 1812, the difference between these militias would have a certain kind of historical aura to them on the one hand, but the difficulties in working with them as compared to professional soldiers.
Yeah, so that's a longstanding tradition in American history. If you take the broad view of American history, broad or narrow view of American history, beginning with English colonial antecedents, you know, Jamestown, Roanoke, Massachusetts, and so forth, those earliest settlers, Puritans, invaders, what have you, who came to these shores, relied upon a tradition that was common in Elizabethan England, which was a reliance on a certain segment of the population in which universal male military service was expected. If you're a male and you're of the right age, generally 18 to 48 or something along those lines, you were obligated to be a member of the militia. It was not a voluntary thing. It was a obligation of subjecthood to the Queen, and it was an obligation also for these colonists in North America. And the frequency with which they trained or drilled varied wildly depending upon the security situation. So if they are engaged, you know, if they have native neighbors who have become hostile, likely because of their own provocations, they would drill, you know, several times a week. Generally speaking, though, in relatively peaceful times, they drill four times a year or something like that. But men were expected to own a serviceable firearm, and they could be fined if they missed muster or if they did not own that firearm. Already by the time of the American Revolution, however, you have a lot of communities that are so far removed from the frontier and from, you know, the possibility of imminent danger, that militia tradition has already begun to fade. It'll fade even further in the 19th century, of course. But the militia remains a pretty important social institution, at least during the American Revolution, because it will allow communities to squash dissent, to enforce a degree of loyalty, predominantly most of the communities. There are some exceptional communities. Norfolk comes to mind as one in which the overwhelming sentiment of the residents is loyalist. But in most of these communities, especially in New England, you know, there may be some loyalist sentiment, but it's kept, you know, pretty much under control by the local militia, which also then is sort of a feeder from which active militia units will be formed. So the militia of any particular town probably is not going to go to war as that militia. Rather, the militia will be used as a feeder organization. They will ask for volunteers. Older citizens of consequence will lean on young men to do their duty. Many young men who are not firstborn sons in particular are at that stage of life where they may have opportunities, but they see in this an opportunity for adventure and so forth. That's the prime kind of material. So they're volunteers by and large, but there are also social pressures that are putting them into the militia. And the concept of the militia is inherently defensive, right? I mean, it's sort of a lowercase r Republican civic virtue obligation of citizenship rather than subjecthood now after the Declaration of Independence to do this duty. But they oftentimes don't like to go on campaigns very far away from home, and they don't conceive of that of really being the nature of their service, that they are supposed to literally defend kith and kin. And so they're not a very good expeditionary tool generally, and their level of training also varies wildly. Now, in New England in particular, because it had been the heavily engaged in each of the four previous wars for empire between France and Great Britain, had the strongest militia and military traditions in any of the 13 colonies in North America. And as the road to revolution, you know, reached something of a bloody climax in 1775, you're seeing them enhance their readiness and form these Minutemen groups, which are the elite within the elite, which is the New England militia establishment. But across the rest of the colonies, in a lot of places, the militia doesn't really mean anything in terms of a usable military force anymore. And in the South in particular, the militia perseveres foremost as a body of armed men to guard against and to potentially put down any slave insurrections. And so those are almost, that's military age manpower that for war making purposes is almost off the table. Because that's, you know, the investment that they feel that they need to make with that manpower is to do that. It's interesting with later day stereotypes about New England and the South in terms of martial spirit and abilities, which are kind of products of the Civil War and Lost Cause mythology. At the time of the Revolution, it's completely inverted. The colonies of Mars are those of New England. I don't think it'd be fair to call the Carolinas or Georgia the colonies of Venus, but John Adams put it aptly when he said, and I'm paraphrasing, of those southern colonies, it is impossible to make a people who have never been warlike. And basically, this is John Adams writing off the southern colonies because they have no really useful militia forces and so forth. That, of course, bespeaks the bias of a New Englander. And in point of fact, some of the over-the-hills militia forces, which are to say, you know, forces that had gone over the Appalachian Mountains and into what is today Tennessee and waged their own independent wars of conquest against the Cherokees, those were Southern militia forces that were actually very, very competent in a quite brutal fashion, as both the Cherokees and the Loyalists at the Battle of Kings Mountain would have later been able to attest.
The militias, I guess, famously less controlled in a situation, whether winning or losing?
Yeah, definitely not subject to the same kind of discipline that is essential to the linear tactics of this age. And this is, of course, where a lot of the confusion about the way Americans fight from the during the Revolution comes from, is with this national mythology that has its roots in the spirit. These are things that the patriots were telling themselves. Right? Our independent spirit, our unwillingness to brook tyrannical authority imposed upon us makes us a more virtuous soldiery, right? We are going to be better than the mindless automatons of Hesse Cassel or of Great Britain who, in the British case, quite truthfully, I mean, the soldiers of the British Army are from the deadest of dead enders, usually, in British society. I mean, the rank and file infantry in the British Army are you know, very hard luck cases. And so there's a little bit of merit to their sense of superiority, I guess, in terms of their constructive utility to peaceful society. But when it comes to war, those redcoats are subject to a very, very harsh brand of discipline, which is already starting to get a little bit humane at this point in time, and that's going to continue on through the 19th century as well. But to make men stand and face fire and what looks to us like certain death relies upon a degree of discipline where you need the soldiers in those ranks to be more afraid of the officers standing behind them than they are of the enemy that's actually shooting at them. And these American yeomen, you know, part-time soldiers who think that they are paragons of civic virtue, they're not in for that kind of discipline. And Washington, as commander of the Continental Army, bemoans this fact because he is confronting a very good conventional army, and he can't do that with the raw material of the militia. And it drives him to distraction by the September of 1776. He's writing to Congress. Every letter to Congress is a, you know, the sky is falling kind of note. And he says to rely upon the militia is to lean on a broken staff. And he wants regulars, which is not to say he doesn't have a place for the militia, but he sees this as a complementary system in which militia have their place, and it's not on a conventional battlefield standing toe-to-toe against the British, if you can help it.
We'll look at exactly how Washington came to terms with this disparate army that he was supposed to turn into a disciplined fighting unit when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest John Hall, and we're looking at tactics during the American Revolutionary War, a war which involved a number of factions on both sides, which came to the war with different ideas about tactics that would succeed in that conflict. And Washington, George Washington, has come onto the scene. By now he's all of about, 43 years old, but a very seasoned commander already. Largely because of his experiences in the French and Indian War. But he is supposed to assume command of an army that doesn't exactly exist yet, does it? I mean, there's not really a Continental Army by 1777, 1778?
Well, so there is in name already in 1776, in 1775, June 14th, which the Army to this day celebrates as its birthday. Each of the services, by the way, celebrates its parent organization's birthday rather than the organization that exists today, because those organizations all essentially ceased to exist at the end of the war. And for the Navy in particular, there's a huge interregnum. There's not a real U.S. Navy until the 1790s. Nevertheless, that's the date which Congress authorizes the formation of a Continental Army and picks George Washington, the natural candidate, to assume command for the reasons you address, and also by virtue of the fact that he's a Virginian, which lends a national character to a conflict that to this point has been very concentrated in New England. So to have somebody from the middle colonies come up and assume command is useful for those reasons as well. And when Washington gets to Boston, you know, what he finds is essentially an ad hoc army of forces that had pursued the British from Lexington and Concord back into Boston, and then just sort of swarmed to Boston and formed siege lines around Boston. And this army of occupation, that was the body and being that Congress designated the Continental Army. And that's the body that George Washington took command of. Iteratively throughout the war, Congress will bend to Washington's pleas and to common sense and the strategic circumstances to make modifications of the policy to expand the army. At the very beginning of the war, Very strong tradition in American history at this point, in British history, to be suspicious of standing armies or regular armies. And even before the revolution began, Americans had sort of convinced themselves of the superiority of the virtuous citizen soldier. And so they thought that they would rely predominantly on militia forces, but they needed, you know, they were going to take advantage of the force that was in being, put Washington in command, and call upon the states to each generate a regiment, you know, provide a line regiment for 1 year to prosecute the war. But that wasn't enough. And in the very early going, George Washington was absolutely aghast at what he regarded as the poor quality of the troops arrayed before him in Boston. Some of this had to do with the culture clash of far more socially stratified Virginia vis-a-vis more egalitarian New England. So Washington is kind of a country squire, second-tier gentryman of Virginia's landholding elite. And he, like most of the European officers, thought that being a gentleman was a prerequisite of exercising command effectively. Like, you know, you needed people of noble or pseudo-noble birth, standing in stature, to command the social deference that was necessary to command these troops. And he gets to New England, and these guys are all electing their own officers. They're all on first-name basis. It's very familiar. And that does not sit well with Washington. And he writes a letter to Martha and describes them as an exceedingly dirty and nasty people. but eventually, he's got to do two things at once. He's got to, like, actually mold this into an army and maintain the siege around Boston and prevent any kind of surprise. And so in that first year in command, he's really more concerned with the act of campaigning. He doesn't have a lot of time for building the force. But one of the very interesting things that happens in this part of the revolution, this first year, as it bears on mythology and reality of tactics during the American Revolution, a lot of people in Congress, John Adams again among them, this is an instance in which him being a New Englander did not cause him to think poorly of some of his more distant patriot neighbors. He was one of a number of legislators who thought that the Americans had an asymmetric advantage in the American riflemen. Okay, so they're thinking of Western Pennsylvania, Western Virginia, the frontier sorts out there, kind of the you know, ilk of folklore, the Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, John Sevier, Andrew Jackson kind of archetype.
Kind of the independent, almost lone wolf sharpshooter.
You're right. The fringed fringed hunting shirt, Kentucky or Pennsylvania long rifle toting guy who was the embodiment of some of these apparent American virtues, right? Like an aversion to social deference and things like that. And so to Washington, you know, he sees this a little bit differently. And when these riflemen show up outside of Boston, he doesn't know what to do with them. His subordinates don't know what to do with them. And a lot of them are, as he already expected from his experience on the Virginia frontier, just a bunch of frontier toughs. I mean, they're very, very rowdy, very undisciplined. And he doesn't quite know what to do with them. But in that first year, he's going to start to work out how to use the riflemen. And what's interesting about this is the British had already kind of gone through this after the Seven Years' War, and their experiments in forming dedicated light infantry kind of frontier formations, the 80th Regiment of Foot under Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Gage. They had already in that war had regularized the idea of every battalion would have its own light infantry company, which would be armed with rifles. Went away for a little bit, but comes back in the early 1770s. And so both sides recognize that the rifle has some potential, but how to use it in this theater kind of remains to be seen. And there are ways to use the rifle, but it's mainly as skirmishers and in roles that would have been assigned to cavalry had there been cavalry around, right? So screening and guarding and covering. So in very loose formations, you'd put these, you know, riflemen out there as sort of sentinels and early warning things, and they can pick out targets at very, very long ranges. In the heat of a contested battle. I mean, a really big battle, though. It's a piece on the battlefield. It's a, you know, like a chess piece that you don't quite know how to play unless there is a very specific place to put them in. And for the most part, both sides are going to find smoothbore line infantry units to be more versatile utility infielders, if you will, for the war, whereas the riflemen are a very specialized kind of force.
Well, let's look, if we can, at a specific battle that would be fought in these tactics that have evolved, some cases re-evolved, for the Revolutionary War. What would it look like?
Well, the one that all Americans remember is the Battle of Bunker Hill, because it's the one battle in which you can make an argument the American militia are at least the equal of the best redcoats that the British Army can throw at them, and they throw them at them three subsequent times. And the death toll, you know, for the British troops is just astronomical. And at the time, and ever since then, Americans would point to this and show, you know, we can do it, and those tactics are foolish, and we would never do such foolish things. But the reality is that the Americans had taken Charlestown and occupied it, and the British couldn't abide that because it would, you know, it rendered vulnerable their position in Boston.
They had the high ground.
They had the high ground, but in terms of its ability to potentially mount guns and cause havoc in Boston and also with any ships that are in the harbor. And they also provided the British an opportunity to demonstrate their resolve and will with a magnificent display of the British fighting prowess by conducting pretty much a frontal attack in multiple waves against the entrenchments on what was actually Breed's Hill. Ultimately, the British did carry the works by you know, moving forward in mass, and you can see in this a couple of things that actually did provide the British an advantage, and not necessarily in that battle, but in subsequent battles, that incredible discipline of the British soldiers
staying on the field,
and continue to endure those kind of casualties and continue to attack and eventually sweep the American lines and take Breed's Hill, but also the reliance upon the bayonet on the attack, and the British will make this sort of a calling card, if you will, of their tactical acumen in North America, is to not waste time and expose themselves to unnecessary enemy fire by pausing while in an attack to fire musket rounds at an entrenched enemy with minimal effect. Just get across that deadly ground and complete the charge with cold steel, with a fearsome bayonet. And that provides the British an immense psychological advantage over their American compatriots. But the Americans don't use bayonets at the beginning of the war. It's not until about the midpoint of the war that the Americans start to use bayonets. And some American commanders will then very much ape the British in this regard. Mad Anthony Wayne being probably the most famous of these. He endured a bayonet attack in defeat at Paoli. He will return the favor at Stony Point. His men don't even have their muskets loaded. Right, and they're going to rely exclusively nighttime attack with bayonets to complete the assault, and with decisive effects. In that regard, British and American tactics sort of converge in terms of their use of the bayonet by mid-war, and the psychological advantage it confers to the British has been muted also by that point.
First of all, it sounds as if the Battle of Bunker Hill is the kind of thing that I hope I'm not jumping around too much here, that we hear about at the Battle of New Orleans, where the Americans were behind barricades and the British were still marching in formation out in the open.
Yes.
But in this case, at Bunker's Hill, they just had such, overwhelming numbers that they could, in effect, get a sufficient force over the hill.
Yes, and they make advantage of the column formation that I mentioned earlier in terms of line versus column. If you're more concerned with having the momentum to carry the works than to be able to spread out and you know have more frontage in which to discharge musketry, that's an illustration of where in that kind of desperate fighting a column formation might be more appropriate. But the Americans are going to hope to pull off the exact same thing for the rest of the war. That becomes kind of the American MO. It's like we will seize terrain that we know they can't abide us holding. We'll entrench and we'll bait them into an attack, and we'll have Bunker Hill over and over again. During the American Revolution, there is only the one Bunker Hill. You're quite right to make the comparison to the Battle of New Orleans, because it is a replay, if you will, at the end of that war. The next major engagement, the Battle of Long Island in 1776, the Americans are all dug in along the Heights, Brooklyn Heights, and across Long Island. And the British, conduct a very effective feint and just go around them and completely turn the Americans out of their position. And for the rest of that devastating, almost catastrophic New York campaign of 1776, Washington cannot manufacture a fight on favorable terms. And it's one reverse after another. And then that fall, all of those one-year enlistments are expiring, and he's largely left. It seems as though he's about to have no army whatsoever. So this is the period in which he is appealing to Congress. I need regulars, and I need them for a longer term of service than 1 year. And Congress will relent. They will authorize 3-year terms of enlistment, and Washington is able to induce a critical core of his army to re-enlist, and the states will raise more troops at that time as well. But it's always fascinated me that we refer to the spirit of 1776 when we really mean the spirit of 1775. The 1775 was the year of
high spirits,
rage militaire,
optimism,
revolutionary fervor. The spirit of 1776 is
pretty
this
dark.
Stinks. I want to go home.
Yes, Valley Forge and all that is. I heard Gore Vidal, the author, one time say that George Washington was not a great general, but he was a great leader.
I think that that's unfair, and I've written a little bit about this. So that Washington is easy to mistake as something that he is not, no matter what light you look at him in. And I would say, you know, aside from, you know, popular hagiography, you know, father of our country, the cherry tree, and all of that, amongst professional military historians for a number of years, he's been characterized in these two largely incompatible manners. The older way was to depict him as being this paragon of an American way of war and knowing better than to fight like the British and so forth. And then the newer wave of scholarship, when I say newer, though, this is all going back to the 60s already, scholars, you know, began to say, like, no, George Washington emulated the British. He wanted to be like the British.
He was a British officer.
He was a British officer, right? And so when he had his portrait painted at the end of the Seven Years' War, one of the best portraits of him as a young man, he's wearing a red coat and wearing a gorget with, you know, which has, you know, Rex George on it or some such. That was his vision of himself, was as a British officer, as a provincial. He never actually got a commission in the British Army, but he was commissioned as an American provincial officer. His half-brother did get a British commission, and that's what he wanted more desperately than anything else. But in recognizing that that was Washington's professional identity and inclination, a subsequent generation of scholars, I think, exaggerated the extent to which he was, unimaginative and not really knowing how to do this. He had a lot to learn as a commanding general, and he certainly made mistakes early in the war. And that 1776 campaign in New York, Manhattan and Long Island, namely, really showcases his I don't know that I would call it insecurity, but how far he has yet to learn at that point. Because, as I said, it's one reverse after another. He continues to defer to a council of war to kind of make decisions by consensus. And he feels bound to obey Congress's instructions to the letter, even when it doesn't necessarily make sense. The fact that he and his army are able to survive that campaign season and pull two rabbits out of a hat at Trenton and Princeton.
I was waiting for Trenton.
That really does save the war effort. And from that point forward, Washington is going to be, I think, the indispensable man. His idea of the strategy for this conflict is perfectly appropriate. Arguably the only strategy that will win the war. Some people have called it Fabian. Some people have described it as a war of posts. But what he understood was that his Continental Army was the center of gravity for the Patriot War effort. It had to exist, it had to be in the field, and it had to represent an existential threat to the British Army. He could not win the War for Independence in a day, but he could lose it if he lost his army. So what he would do is keep his army at just far enough away from British main force units that it would never be susceptible to getting trapped and annihilated or being forced to surrender, but close enough to the enemy that he could take jabs at it at his leisure. And what he was looking for was the opportunity to land what he called brilliant strokes. And so you might compare this to, you know, the 1,000 cuts, right, bringing down the elephant. His game was like, you know, jab, but parry, and never let a knockout blow hit his army, but look for an opportunity to land a brilliant stroke. He'd hoped to get one at Germantown. He didn't get it. It wasn't really until the end of the war that he got a truly brilliant stroke, landed at Yorktown. Mm-hmm. But that his strategy was appropriate for the war that the Americans were waging.
Well, he was trained in the British style of military tactics, Washington was, but would the British ever have done a night attack like Washington did, you know, crossing the Delaware in the middle of winter when armies traditionally were in winter quarters and hunkered down for the season?
Yeah, absolutely. They would have done that. So there's a great deal of innovation going on in European armies at this time. I've described the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, as World War I. There's this old canard about generals always studying the last war. They should, right? The general who's not studying the last war is a very bad general. But you had a war on a historic scale waged in the Seven Years' War, and an army that was regarded as the best in the world, the French army, defeated in that conflict. You can understand that that's going to cause some soul searching, you know. And the British went through this learning curve in North America and got pretty adept at North American woodland fighting. So this is not a period of insipid minds, you know, just leaning on tradition and doing dumb things. There's a lot of innovation. The formations are constantly changing. There's lots of debates about the right tactical formations, about what we would today call combined arms formations, combining infantry, cavalry, and artillery at the same time. And in France in particular is undergoing really a military renaissance after this humiliating defeat in the Seven Years' War at that time. And they're all also experimenting with these kind of light and irregular formations, ranger units, or they use native allies. That had been picking up steam as early as the 1740s. And just about every European power recognized the need to have something akin to light infantry forces, whether they were indigenous allies or raised special purpose partisans, they called them.
Fascinating stuff, in the abstract at least, not necessarily a place you would want to participate in, but looking at it from the armchair, fascinating stuff. And thanks, John Hall.
Thank you, Norman.
Military tactics during the American Revolution. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join me next time around. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and this is University of the Air.